This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Trumpet Hour. Our panel of trumpet writers are all ready to go. They're anxious to tell you about the major trends that have become more evident this week and the big events that happened. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here. Today we'll be talking about inflation in America and the effects that welfare policies have on marriage rates.
Okay, and we also have Kieran Underwood.
Thanks for inviting me. Today I'll be talking about Japan's new nationalist defense minister and what she had to face on her first day.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Oh, good afternoon. The EU is doing business with one of the most evil leaders on the planet. They've decided to hand over well over $100 million in cash to a convicted war criminal.
And also via Skype from Britain, where he's visiting this week, we have Brent Noctegal.
Well, some believe that the United States is doing business also with one of the most evil leaders on the planet, this time to the tune of $400 million, and we'll talk about that as well.
Okay, well, one ongoing story that has really dominated headlines this year and last has been the rise of Islamist attacks on European soil. The Middle East has been suffering debilitating conflicts which have displaced almost entire populations in some cases, and some European leaders have responded in part by swinging the doors to the continent wide open to all those displaced, to the refugees, to the asylum seekers. But the problem is that a number of those who enter are unwilling to assimilate into European culture. And in some cases, they're bent on clashing with that culture, determined to terrorize and destroy as much of it as possible. We've seen it with the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris last year, and then later in the year at the concert and stadium in Paris. We've seen it in the savage Brussels attacks in March of this year, and then in Nice last month, and the spate of German attacks also last month. And then most recently, a really barbaric attack in Rouen, France, where Islamists targeted the most sacrosanct and universal aspect of Europe's culture by slitting the throat of a Catholic priest. Some European leaders have really just shocked and appalled the world with their response to all this, saying that the people of Europe need to basically just get used to all the carnage, and that we should just expect Islamist massacres to happen from time to time. But others are calling for an entirely different approach. To tell us about these calls and the clash of civilizations that it looks like it's leading toward, we'll go to Richard.
Good afternoon. Yes, I want to talk about what I just thought was a really exceptional article showing where this is leading that Foreign Policy published last week. And you're right, at the moment from leaders in the West, we've seen a very soft response, though, and it's getting unpopular. Just today, Reuters had a piece called Angela Merkel's Approval Rating Plummets After Terrorist Attack. I think we saw that a bit too late to get it in the Trumpet Weekly, but we'll probably get that in next week, where her approval rating is her second lowest since she was re-elected in 2013. So these attacks are really having an impact in the way people think, the way people see their leaders. And this article was called How to Start a Clash of Civilizations by James Poulos in Foreign Policy. And he did a great job of just going back to a lot of the history that we've talked about on this program in the Trumpet Magazine, and that's Europe's Catholic heritage. He wrote that the truth is there's no better way to shake Europe out of what many see as its guilt-ridden paralysis than to assault French Catholicism, the oldest, most ingrained force that transcends nationalism in Europe's most powerful nation. And really, it transcends this national divide across the whole continent. Just about all of Europe has these deep links to the Catholic Church and has a lot of heritage there. And this article, he goes back and talks about how many of the founders of the European Union were themselves Catholic, how it was, you know, this was part of their religious belief played a major part in pushing for this union. And even the Catholic Church has begun the process, has begun looking into, it's not actually making them saints, but a step or two below saints for some of these Catholic politicians. And if that were the case, it would be one of the first times a politician had been beatified since, I think, something like the 14th century. So these ties that they have are very significant. And so it talks about this article talks about that these founding fathers of Europe recapitulated a vision of continental unity as old as Charlemagne. And that's something that'll be very familiar with for our listeners, because, you know, we talk all the time about how Charlemagne was a model for many of these European leaders, and how Catholic religion played a major role for Charlemagne. It was, you know, the nuts and bolts of his administration was really carried out by Catholic priests, and the Catholic Church ran education. Then he saw a major duty of his state to be spreading the Catholic Church. The other example that he brings out here is Napoleon Bonaparte. And, you know, I know you know this very well, Jeremiah, because I think you wrote an article about it, how the French Revolution was very secular. They tried to get away even from the seven-day week and introduced their own 10-day week. And Napoleon Bonaparte came out of that, and he was initially, at least at first, a very fervent believer in a lot of those revolutionary ideas. When he was on military campaign in Italy, he fought against the Catholic Church. He even put out death warrants for priests and this kind of thing. He was very annoyed with the trouble the Catholic Church stirred up to what he was trying to do in Italy. But when he took over France, pretty soon he signed a concordat with the Catholic Church. And he saw, he really tried to have a secular administration, but he saw really the way to unite all of Europe under him, to cement his influence in France, to spread it beyond France, was to form an agreement with the Catholic Church. And I think that's a very close parallel to what we could see now with the European Union. They did have those Catholic founding fathers, but these days a lot of the liberal kind of metropolitan elite that populate EU offices are very secular. And they would, I think, prefer to run a secular state, but they're going to run into the same kind of things as problems as Napoleon, and find that they need the Catholic Church as this force for unity. So you're seeing now the Catholic Church directly under attack from radical Islam. You're seeing also all of Europe very worried about radical Islam, looking for a solution to this problem. And the Catholic Church is standing right there as a very potent source for both unity and to kind of rally Europe against the radical Islamist threat that they're facing.
Yes. Yeah, it does seem like, you know, it's in that unique position, the Catholic Church, that it's always been in, really, for Europe to assimilate all the disparate peoples, and to just provide that glue between them, that, you know, everyone from Charlemagne to Napoleon, as you mentioned, and even the Third Reich there have capitalized on to wage those campaigns of conquest.
Right, and it goes even beyond the migrant crisis. I mean, there's division everywhere. There's division between the northern states that are making money and the southern states that are spending a lot of money. And you can really see the power then for, I mean, Europe's vision as it is now of this secular union has kind of run out of steam. And you can see now the power that the Catholic Church could potentially wield by presenting a new vision and by helping unify even that these two different camps in a situation that's entirely separate to this migrant crisis and the terrorism crisis. So a lot of potential for what the Catholic Church could do. And I thought this article just really highlighted that very well.
Yes, and you mentioned Merkel's plummeting approval rating there, and she's sort of chief among those seculars, I think, in a way. I'm wondering if, based on what you've read and seen with the growing unrest among Europeans, how long do you expect her to survive and to remain Germany's leader?
Yeah, that's a good question. And until now, nobody's made any money betting against Angela Merkel.
Right.
She is the great survivor, and she has come through a whole load of different different potential downfalls. However, she's been in charge a long time. I believe this is her third term. This is her third term in office. Even to fulfill three terms would be a huge achievement. I mean, she's starting to reach her expiry date anyway. And then, I mean, you look at the potential that Europe has really to explode now with Islam, with this Islamic terrorism, with all the problems that are threatening by the from migrants. The fact that an instability in Turkey in the Middle East could cause the migrant crisis to get even worse. And she really owns both those crises. So if either of these crises just really gets out of control, you could see her being toast very quickly. It would be hard for her to stay around. So I think it depends on the intensity of those crises. And so if you see those really accelerate, she'll find it harder to stick around. Even if they don't, she's going to be gone within the next few years anyway, just because she's been around for so long.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Richard. And while we're on the subject of terrorism, we want to talk about a couple of stories showing where terrorists and terrorist-sponsoring entities receive their funding from. And it turns out that a surprising amount of that funding may be from you and me, from tax dollars and charitable contributions originating in Western nations. To tell us about two different sobering revelations that came to light this week, we'll turn to our Middle East analyst, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, the first of those where the money was gotten by tax revenues comes from the United States. And this is a story that we have reported on before, but it came to the news, more back into the news this week, of how, because of how this money was delivered, this came to light. And it followed a Wall Street Journal piece that was highly cited all over the world. And it referred to the $400 million that was paid to Iran upon the same day that four United States citizens were released from Iran. I'll just start out by quoting this article from the Wall Street Journal. It says the Obama administration secretly organized an airlift of $400 million worth of cash to Iran that coincided with the January release of four Americans detained in Iran. So the load of cash was on wooden pallets stacked. It wasn't American dollars because apparently they can't give them American dollars. So it was euros and Swiss francs and other currencies. And they were flown to Iran in an unmarked cargo plane and delivered there in Tehran on January 17. Now, it's interesting because even after this piece came out, there was a lot of back and forth that went on. People questioning Mr. Obama and asking whether this is was a ransom payment for these men. And he said, no, this was in regards to 30 years or 35 years of litigation against the United States from a deal whereby the United States received money to supply Iran with fighter jets before 1979, before the takeover, before the Iranian Revolution. So they owed the Shah these jets, but they didn't end up fulfilling that order because the Islamists took control. So they basically want their money back. Well, the Iranian leadership wants their money back. So the United States have said for the past 6 months even that this money related purely to fulfilling what they owed the Iranians and had absolutely nothing to do with the releasing of these hostages. And yet, the very clandestine manner in which it was delivered and for the fact that they didn't release those facts at least they haven't come into light until now, shows that something was done in secret here that has a lot of people wondering whether this was, in fact, a ransom payment. It wasn't just coincidence.
And also the timing, just the fact that the funds were received, hours or days before those hostages were finally released.
Yeah, not even days. It looks like it was the same day. In fact, one of those four people that were released back to the United States said that before they could fly out from this airport in Iran, that he was told that they were waiting for another plane to arrive. In fact, all the pilot was ready, the crew was ready to deliver the Americans back, but they had to wait overnight in this airport and sleep there for another plane to arrive. Now, we don't know. This is just coming from one of the detainees, so we don't know for sure if that plane did carry the cash or not, but it's interesting that this type of scenario was reported by one of those Americans there. There, I'd just like to read a quote from Jonah Goldberg. He's commenting on this Wall Street Journal piece, because inside the Wall Street Journal piece, there is an interesting comment. First of all, I'll just quote the Wall Street Journal. It said that the U.S. officials also acknowledged that Iranian negotiators on the prisoner exchange said they wanted the cash to show they had gained something tangible. So while the United States says it wasn't ransom money, the Iranian negotiators are basically saying that the release of the prisoners was conditional on getting the money, and that U.S. officials are aware that that's the way that they were thinking. Now, the big thing here is that people are worried about is, do we pay ransom against kidnapped Americans across the world? And of course, it's been a longstanding policy not to do that. And yet you wouldn't do that because it encourages, obviously, more people to be kidnapped if they know they can get money from it. But the fact that the Iranians believe it was ransom money speaks to the greater point that it doesn't matter whether it was or it wasn't. The people that do the kidnapping believe it was, and therefore it is going to encourage more Americans to be kidnapped. And this is quite a sum of money as well, $400 billion. And it's only the first installment of 1.7, so there's more to come. And that's what people are asking as well. What's Iran going to do with this money? Well, we already know, and we've talked at length on this program, at what they do with their extra funds.
Right. Yeah, just using as much of that as possible to sponsor terrorist activities. Well, we really appreciate you sharing that with us, Brent. You are listening to The Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. There's certainly a lot to talk about with the rising tide of terrorism and where the funding for it comes from and where all of that is leading. But for our next story, we're going to look at another part of the world and another pair of trends that The Trumpet monitors. And those are Japan's march toward remilitarization and the rising belligerence of the hermit kingdom, North Korea. Two trends that often overlap and perpetuate one another. For this, we will go to Kieran.
Oh, thanks for having me here. And for this story, I think we need a little bit of context, especially for Japan. And the context comes from World War II. After World War II, Japan's constitution was written up. General MacArthur told them they had a week to get a constitution done. And it today we know as the Peace Constitution of Japan. And the most important part of that constitution is Article 9, where it says that the Japanese people will forever renounce war as a sovereign right of their nation and renounce the threat or the use of force as a means of settling international disputes. So ever since then, Japan has been known as a pacifist nation because of that article in its constitution. So their prime minister, Shinzo Abe, who's been prime minister since 2012, has been very, very vocal in his idea that this Article 9 needs to be changed, or at least amended for Japan to use a little bit more of its military forces to have some influence on the world. So he's part of the Liberal Democratic Party, which might seem a little bit strange to some American listeners, considering that their Liberal Democratic Party really is center-right and not at all liberal in the terms that we would think of it. So he is very much a nationalist prime minister for Japan. So he did a cabinet reshuffle on just this past Wednesday. And with that, he appointed another nationalist defense minister, this time a woman named Tomomi Inada. Now, this isn't really a big surprise since he's nationalist and she's nationalist and the party is center-right. But two other things happened which were very impactful on the same day that she was announced as the new defense minister. The first one was that China and South Korea both denounced the appointment, said this is just Japan wanting to militarize. Of course, China consistently says those things of Japan, and South Korea once rejected the Inada from coming to South Korea because of some of her controversial views about the parts of Japan in World War II. But on that same day, North Korea launched a ballistic missile. So this was on Wednesday, and launched it, and it landed within Japanese-controlled waters. This was the first time it's happened. And, of course, it was in defiance of a United Nations Security Council resolution. But it's one thing to defy a resolution by doing it in your own waters. But it's another thing to defy that resolution by firing into someone else's waters, and this was Japan's waters. So imagine if you were to become the defense minister, and on the same day, North Korea fires a missile into your own waters. I mean, talk about a rough first day on the job. That's what she had to deal with the first day. But really, the impact of this and the major trend that the new defense minister, Inada, will have is using Japan's self-defense forces to make it a little more normal for the Japanese people to see them using their forces. A couple of years ago, they were able to go and use their forces in the UN strictly to do with non-militaristic actions. But if she continues to use them, and she indicates that she will as much as possible, it really will be a normalizing factor and change the public opinion, I believe, of how they view Article 9 in the Constitution. Of course, she will not have any impact on whether or not the Constitution will be changed, because just like in the American Constitution, you need a two-thirds majority in both houses to get it changed. But along with that, Japan's public also needs to be questioned, and a majority needs to also agree with that amendment. So she won't be instrumental, but I think she will be instrumental in normalizing Japan's use of their self-defense forces.
And it sounds like North Korea will also be instrumental in that. As the Japanese leadership and the public see this increasingly belligerent country, you know, firing missiles right into the territorial waters of Japan, that will make more and more of them say, we need to, you know, no longer rely on the U.S. for our security assurances. We need to be able to take action against this rogue nation, this hermit kingdom that has no regard at all for international law. And I think that also the increasingly aggressive behavior from China is accomplishing the same thing among the Japanese populace.
Yeah.
Well, we really appreciate that, Kieran. It's a vital place for us to keep our eye on for sure. Well, moving back westward to the United States, the U.S. government just released the latest inflation report, and this report says it's smooth sailing for America and for the greenback, the U.S. dollar. It says inflation rates have remained very low and at a healthy level, but some analysts are saying that this inflation has been underreported to a pretty significant degree. For this story, we'll go to one of our U.S. economy watchers, Andrew.
Right. Yeah, well, inflation rates in any nation, and I guess probably particularly in America, they've always been controversial, and they're just in to figure out, like, how do you figure out what inflation is? Like you mentioned, they just released their latest report, said that inflation rates in America are 1%. Anyone who's been to a grocery store recently might take issue with that statistic. And the reason is like I said, there are a lot of gray areas in how you calculate like that. For example, they don't count food or gasoline in the inflation statistics because droughts or wars or other things can influence the price of those commodities other than just currency value. They also, like for electronics, if you get an iPhone 6 and it's more expensive than the iPhone 5 was when it came out, they'll attribute the cost increase to the fact that the iPhone 6 has a better computer chip processor in it,
right,
instead of to the inflation. So they've and the government's changed the equation they've used to calculate it several times over the years, and that's actually what this article that we've drawn attention to in our Trumpet Weekly from Zero Hedge points out, that there are other equations that they've used that are saying that the inflation rate's not really 1%. It's actually probably closer to 7 to 13%.
Quite a discrepancy.
So quite a discrepancy. And you can, And actually, we hit double-digit inflation in the 70s in America, but they used a different equation back then. And if we actually used the same equation, you'd probably get a number much closer to the 7% than the current equation that gives the 1% now. So that's something people will argue back and forth over. But what you can't argue is that the cost of living in the United States is definitely going up a lot faster than 1%. And as this article from Zero Hedge that we've drawn attention to in our Trumpet Weekly points out, the government does actually have kind of a vested interest in using whatever equation gives you the lowest number, because for several reasons. They draw out four reasons. For one, all your Social Security and welfare beneficiaries, they get a cost of living increase every single year. And right now their cost of living increase is probably pretty much the same as inflation, like 1%. If the government actually admitted that inflation was closer to 7%, all those people are going to want a 7% raise on their government entitlements each year.
Right.
Same with a nation like China. We're giving them 2% interest on their bonds, their treasury bonds they buy from us. So according to our 1% inflation, China is making a 1% profit on those bonds, where if you admit that it's 7%, then China's got to realize that, no, you're not making a 1% profit. You're making a 6% loss buying American treasury bonds. And then they'd want more. And that would actually be the bigger catastrophe, in that if we had to pay 7% on our treasury bonds, like the vast majority of the federal government's budget would start going to interest payments instead of like running the country. And that's what Charles Hughes Smith really brings out in this report, which I encourage you to get the Trumpet Weekly and read, that for the government to just come out and admit 7% inflation could even collapse the entire economic system. And wow. So they've definitely got a vested interest in trying to lay out all the equation possibilities they have and pick the one that gives you the lowest number to just try to keep things calm.
To downplay that. Well, as compromised as the American economy is, it still looks like, compared to the economic situation in China and Russia and Europe and in most of the other G20 places, it looks like the U.S. is, at least on the surface, doing comparatively well. So I wonder, what do you think it would take for the American economy to really fall apart, to be exposed as that moth-eaten coat that it is?
Right. Well, like you said, yeah, many nations around the world are dealing, pretty much all the nations except for maybe the European Union, they do whatever it takes to keep inflation low, but then they get their unemployment really high because of that. But eventually, I think what it would take for the American economy to collapse is just what I mentioned beginning before, is foreign nations realizing how moth-eaten the economy is and demanding a higher interest rate. And then historically, once a nation has to spend more on interest than it spends on defense, that's when it collapses. That's when Rome collapsed. That's when the Soviet Union collapsed. We would already be to that point if it wasn't for the fact that we have such historically low interest rates. So All it would take to collapse America's economy right now is one of our major creditors to wake up to the fact that the 2% interest they're getting on their treasury bonds is not a long-term solution.
So it wouldn't take much, and it could happen really quickly. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to the Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial, and the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about the checkered past of the European Union's new best friend, a new offensive launched against the Islamic State in Libya, Silicon Valley being overtaken by China's mobile technology, and a correlation between welfare and marriage. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. One headline that you may have missed this week was about a new partner that the European Union has been cozying up next to. And he's a man whose past should trigger all kinds of red flags and warnings that would make any respectable political entity avoid all cooperation with him. This man is the president of Sudan. To tell us about the EU's sudden outreach to this dangerous figure and what is motivating it, we'll turn to our Europe analyst, Richard.
Since about April this year, the EU has been extending more and more money to the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir. And he was the very first ever head of state to be indicted for war crimes by the UN-backed International Criminal Court. He invited a certain Osama bin Laden to come and stay in his country for a while back in the 90s. He has worked very closely with Iranian terrorist groups, allowing Iranian-backed terrorists to set up training camps within Sudan. So not really the track record of someone you would expect the European Union to work with. However, they are so desperate with the migrant crisis and with radical terrorists coming across their borders that they are prepared to work with just about anyone. We saw this with their probably illegal deal that they struck with Recep Tayyip Erdogan, where they kind of went against everything that modern Europe usually stands for. And we're seeing the same now in working with Omar al-Bashir. And he is such a outlaw, or international outlaw, if I could put it that way, that he can't even visit Europe without being arrested. And actually, he went to South Africa last year and barely left the country in time before getting arrested there.
What are the specific charges that have led to those arrest warrants?
Well, it's mostly war crimes for Darfur and the war that led to South Sudan becoming independent.
Okay.
And the various different conflicts that have been going on for quite some years surrounding that. But the EU, they've decided that he is going to get a good chunk of a $2 billion emergency trust fund for Africa that they've put together. So he's going to receive 110 billion euros. So that'd be well over 110 million euros. So that's well over 100 million US dollars. Mm-hmm. That's a huge amount of support. He's also getting a 45 million grant. It's not clear whether that is part of that 110 or whether that's separate. And that is to basically build a massive prison for migrants entering his country. So Sudan, with its quite central position, a lot of migrants enter Sudan and they would use that to travel then up into northern Africa, into these countries that border the Mediterranean, get on boats and come to the European Union. Now they're paying him to essentially lock all those people up or deport them back to where they came. A lot of these people are coming from places like Eritrea, where the EU is by their human rights laws, cannot deport people because of the condition that they'd be treated when they get there. So instead, they're paying a wanted international war criminal to detain these people and send them back instead. Now, in some ways, this is realpolitik. You've got to do what you've got to do to keep your borders safe. But there is a lot of hypocrisy in the way the European Union handles this. They try to have this outward facade of being the most human rights loving, liberal, kindest democracy or set of democracies in the world, while at the same time paying one of the most evil leaders in the world to do their dirty work. There is more, I think, realpolitik to this, though, than simply the migrant crisis, because the other thing that gets very interesting here is Sudan, until recently, has been Iran's number one partner in Africa. Conflict Arms Research, for example, did a lot of work tracking various different small arms shipments that had come into rebel groups all across the region, and the vast majority of them track back to coming from Iran through Sudan. And not just small arms, even more advanced weapons, exactly the same thing. A lot of Hamas's best rockets came from Iran through Sudan. They've been an absolutely crucial partner, or a central partner, to everything Iran's been doing in the region. However, that started to change at the beginning of this year. They switched from the Iranian camp to the Saudi camp, And I think it was, again, around the same time, around April, maybe a bit earlier, March, that they started getting this EU funding. They started also joining the anti-Shiite coalition in Yemen and siding militarily with Saudi Arabia and not Iran. So you go back a few years, Mr. Flurry had an article that where he started by talking about how Europe, and he wrote that Europe and Iran are going to enter, you know, that Africa is becoming a battleground between these powers and it's going to take on more and more importance. And I think we could well be seeing that in Sudan. Is this part of working with the Saudis to try and make sure that this central partner for Iran is prized out of the Iranian orbit and brought into the Sunni orbit and this alliance of Muslim states that Europe is building that is more closely aligned with Europe? And are they trying to deny Iran this ally here?
Wow, well, that is a really sobering development. We thank you for that, Richard. And for this next story, we'll stay near Sudan, just jumping over the border to the north, to the neighboring country of Libya. Since the violent overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi a few years back there, Libya has been suffering all kinds of mayhem and destabilization. Perhaps most alarmingly, the Islamic State has taken over great swaths of Libya's territory. And to tell us about a new offensive that has been launched against these Islamic State terrorists, we'll turn once again to Brent.
Yeah, so this week we finally had some action against the Islamic State by the Americans in Libya. We've talked at length about how on Libya's coast in the city of Sirte, Islamic State has taken root. Earlier this year, there was expected to be about 5,000 fighters there. For the Islamic State, around at this time, it looks like there's about 1,000 left. And finally, according to many commentators, this government in Libya has requested help, foreign help, to battle ISIS. And the United States are leading this offensive. It's mainly just strikes, air campaign against the Islamic State in this town. It's called Operation Odyssey Lightning. Quite the name for it. But it's got people wondering just how effective it's going to be if it's just going to be the air campaign, similar to what we're seeing them do in Syria against the Islamic State, in Iraq against the Islamic State, and whether it could develop into something more than just an air campaign.
So it really sounds like this is a more intense American response than anything we've seen there, at least recently. Do you have any speculation about how successful this offensive might be if it, you know, if it stays shy of boots on the ground? Is the U.S. committed enough to this to affect any real change in Libya's status quo?
Well, I do feel it's interesting if we are coming into President Obama's final months in office. He needs a victory against the Islamic State. He might have given up on the Assyria-Iraq battlefield. And Libya, with just 1,000 fighters there, he might believe that that is possible and he can take a win. But the big question here, as it is in Syria and Iraq, what happens after Islamic State is gone? A lot of people that are in Libya that aren't related to the UN American-backed government of national accord are very worried that post-Islamic State, you're going to have a situation equally as bad, because instead of having a common enemy among the rivaling factions in Libya that are still rivaling to this day, you're going to remove that common enemy, and therefore there will be greater bloodshed with them fighting against one another. So instead of rallying Libyans together in unity, they have instead trying to destroy the only factor that probably could have brought them together. So a lot of commentators don't see this as a positive end result, even though the Islamic State might lose some ground in Libya.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that, Brent. Well, we spoke earlier very briefly about the U.S. economy and how it interacts with and compares to that of China. And one report emerged this week saying that in one vital sector, which America has long dominated and been on the cutting edge of, China is suddenly pulling ahead. To explain what it all means, we'll turn once again to Kieran.
If you've used Snapchat or Kik with their drunken checkerboard QR codes, if you've used Facebook's ability to hail rides, if you've used their function to make payments with its Messenger app, if you use Twitter's live streaming video, then you have been using the latest mobile technology, popularized not in Silicon Valley, but actually in China. Now, if you're a big follower of the tech world, this might not be entirely new for you, but it is definitely new for a lot of people. And the New York Times published a feature article about this subject called China, Not Silicon Valley, is the Cutting Edge in Mobile Tech. Now, China has for a long time had this reputation of being technology stealers or technology copiers, and the reason for that is they do actually do that. They've copied and stealed U.S. technology, especially with computers in military. But even last month, the world's fastest supercomputer was built by China. But what was surprising about it in the tech world was not that they built the fastest, because they also have many other second and third, I think, but that they built it without U.S. chip technology. Hmm. So China, although it has this reputation for having government censorship of their technology with Google, YouTube, and Twitter, and those type of things, it's really hard to stop a nation which has over a billion people and is developing and has so many people using phones. If you walk around China, you might be surprised to find out that in the cities that everyone is on their phones, just like in Western countries. So part of this new development in the recent years has been to do with how China and the US approach the way they make different apps in mobile technology. And in the United States, I think this is probably because of Apple's big influence. Technology firms emphasize simplicity. An app is meant to be extremely functional and meant to be used to do one specific task. But in China, it's three major internet companies, Alibaba, Baidu, and WeChat, all compete to create a single app that has as many functions as they can stuff into it. So from this New York Times piece, he talked about Alibaba's shopping app, where you can buy groceries, buy credits for online games, you can scan coupons and find deals at stores nearby. And then Baidu's mapping app lets users order Uber, which is the car rentals or like a taxi service, and reserve hotels or restaurants, buy food, buy movie tickets, and anything in stores nearby. So they really want to create this kind of like an ultimate app. And China has really been advanced in that. Another quote from the founder of a tech research firm called Strategy, Ben Thompson, said, quite frankly, the trope that China copies the US hasn't been true for years. And in mobile, it's the opposite. The US often copies China.
Wow. So in an area where we've had the lead for so many years and even decades, we're suddenly really, really falling behind to this nation of 1.4 billion people, more and more of which are online and are, you know, rapidly using these various apps. Well, thank you very much for that, Kieran. Last, it's time to talk about helping people who need help. Every human society has people who can't support themselves. Babies, children, elderly, sick, and disabled. Traditionally, the natural institution of the family has provided the care and protection that these dependent people need. But over the last half century, more and more Americans have been giving up on traditional family life and instead relying on the U.S. government to provide for them. This shift toward government reliance has had all kinds of unexpected and deleterious consequences for America. And this week, a new report was published showing one more of these destructive consequences. To tell us about this, we'll turn again to Andrew.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's many people who would argue that both the family structure and the economy in America have been just fundamentally transformed in the last half century. You go back to 1950s and 75% of adults were married. It's now less than half. You go back to the 1950s, and most people were reliant upon their family if they were sick or if they were ill or if they were a child or if they were unemployed for an extended period of time, to where now, again, it's actually over half of the U.S. population is reliant on the government for some sort of social entitlement. And that includes Social Security, which I realize people have paid into. So it's kind of like half social entitlement, half savings account. Yeah. But there is a limited but I think those two trends are linked, although there's always been a little bit of a chicken and an egg paradox with that. They're like, okay, are more people relying on the government because the family is breaking down, or is the family breaking down because more people are relying on the government? And this new study, which we've showed in our we have in our Trumpet Weekly by the American Enterprise Institute, put some evidence to the latter, which realizing that people who are on welfare are actually choosing not to get married because they would lose some of their welfare benefit. In this particular study, they just they looked at lower middle class families and found that there's only maybe about 4% of those who would get married. They would have gotten married if they wouldn't have lost the welfare benefit, but are now choosing to just cohabitate together so that they both get their individual welfare checks. Now, as a bit of anecdotal evidence that's also put in the study, they're, even though they found 4%, they also found that they're, I think, like a third of adults in that lower middle class said that they knew someone, like a friend or a relative of theirs, who also wasn't getting married for fear of losing welfare checks. Now, their analysis in the study is that they need to remove the marriage penalty from the welfare system. Now they've got, if you have two people on individual welfare checks and then they get married because they have a combined income, they no longer qualify. So they're recommending they remove that marriage penalty, although there are definitely others who can make the case that actually if you just scaled back the welfare state itself slowly, hopefully you'd encourage more families to form and actually go back to the more traditional way that things were done in America.
Okay, it looks like Richard has a comment.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, this process that you're describing where the government takes over from the family is even more advanced in the UK. And one thing we saw more under the Labour government, when they were more generous, if I could call it that, with welfare, was young ladies having babies out of wedlock because of the extra money that it gave them. And that is hugely damaging for the child's future, for the economy, for the nation as a whole, the family, if you're a government incentivizing single mothers.
Right. No, yeah, we are definitely, I definitely agree that Britain's probably a little further down that path than America is, even though they are both heading in that direction. And it's, I don't know, some may find it kind of a cynical way to look at it. But really, when you do get down to it, like Jeremiah pointed out at the beginning, is that for these people who are dependent, the young or the old or the sick, I mean, it's either the family or the government who takes care of them. And mm-hmm. So in some ways, that does actually make them natural rivals, in that if you were of a political ideology that favored big government, just pragmatically, you'd realize that a weak family structure benefits you, because then the government wins out in this competition for who's going to take care of these people. And so oftentimes you'll find in the societies, the stronger the family structure, the smaller the federal government will be.
So a government that wants to boost its own power would do its best to erode the power of families.
Right. Some of the early communist governments, like in Soviet Russia, are the only example I can think of where they were actually that honest about it, where they just came out and said that, like, no, we want to destroy the family as the economic unit of society because that will make the state supreme. And I don't think either in America or in Britain there's anyone who's actually just at least verbally making that case. But whether that's your goal or not, that is the effect when the family breaks down. You'd create more people who need the state to take care of them.
Thank you for that, Andrew. This is the Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All of these stories that we're talking about today are in there. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all of our panelists coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some headlines from this week that caught our attention. First, we'll go to Richard.
A 19-year-old Norwegian national of Somali origin killed one woman and injured five in a knife attack in London in Russell Square, not far from the British Museum. They haven't said whether that was terrorism yet. They said they're investigating it. They have said that mental health was involved, though I think the argument there is a little circular. Only crazy people stab people in the streets. Therefore, this person must have stabbed them because he was crazy. So it'd be interesting to see what exactly was going on there. But you have another attack by a Muslim in a European country or someone with a Muslim background.
Okay, and Kieran.
The Islamic State released a video on Sunday calling for jihad against Russia. In a 9-minute YouTube video, a masked man addressed Russian President Vladimir Putin and threatened that Islamic State terrorists will be coming after Russia. Personally, I don't think Vladimir Putin was that worried.
Andrew.
Yes, the Center for Disease Control in the United States issued its first area-specific warning this Monday for a U.S. state. The center is now advising that pregnant women not travel to Wynwood, Florida, due to the outbreak of the Zika virus, the mosquito-borne Zika virus in the area, and the effects that it could have on an unborn child.
Okay, next we'll go to Brent.
It was revealed this week that the World Vision Organization, one of the largest charity organizations in the world, was infiltrated by a Hamas agent back in 2004 who was set up to, quote, be on a very focused mission to penetrate an international aid organization and exploit its resources. That's what the Israeli Security Services Shin Bet said. So he has stolen over or misappropriated the funds, if I could say that, of $7.2 million. Instead of going to humanitarian assistance, it went to weapons acquisitions, tunnel building, and preparations for the next war with Israel. That is scary to think that people's charitable donations are going towards the fight against Israeli civilians.
Scary for sure. We'll go once again now to Richard.
Germany is getting ready to allow troops on the streets for the first time since World War II. This has been something that the Christian Democrats in Germany have been pushing for somewhere around 20 years. They've not done it or got it through, but now it looks like they're going to. Paris has opened all our eyes. I'd rather have skepticism now than the accusation that we weren't prepared, said Ursula von der Leyen, the defense minister. So this is another kind of restriction that was imposed upon Germany after World War II that is now being thrown off. And Josue Michels has written more on this in an article called The Danger of Deploying the German Army at Home.
Okay, and back to Kieran.
The Black Lives Matter movement released its first written statement this Monday, detailing the demands and policy recommendations for the United States. Among the demands were a demand to end the war against black people and demanding reparations for past and continuing harms. Some of the policies regarding America's police were the reallocations of funds from policing and incarceration to education and employment, and a retroactive decriminalization and immediate release of all drug-related offenses and prostitution-related offenses.
Okay, and lastly, we'll go one more time to Andrew.
An agent of the Islamic State was arrested in North Carolina this week on charges of trying to create a sleeper cell to conduct terrorist attacks against Americans. He told the FBI officials that he had 10 accomplices, who most of which were still in Mexico, using the southern border as their base of operations.
I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we are coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All of these stories are in this week's edition. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel, Andrew Miller, Kieran Underwood, Brent Noctegal, and Richard Palmer.
Thanks very much.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you today with the words of the Danish physicist Niels Bohr. The opposite of a correct statement is a false statement, but the opposite of a profound truth may well be another profound truth. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.